This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. In the last decade, we've become familiar with talk of the spectrum, the range of disorders that include autism and Asperger syndrome. They can be terrible disabilities, but not apparently for Tim Page. In fact, he seems to think that Asperger's has been one of the keys to his brilliant career. Page was not diagnosed with the syndrome until well into adulthood. He'd already been a music critic for the New York Times and the Washington Post and a great author, in fact, winner of the Pulitzer Prize. He tells his story in a new memoir called Parallel Play. Tim Page, welcome back to Studio 360.
It's great to see you, Kurt.
Can you describe the day that you finally put this name to this condition that you'd had your whole life?
Sure, I can. And this is something I didn't talk about in the book, and I didn't talk about in the original article, but I now have permission from the other party involved, who is one of my sons, my second son. And I went with him to a therapist, and we talked a lot with the therapist. We talked.
This is how long ago?
This is almost 10 years ago. He was only 10 at that point. Basically, the doctor said he has this condition called Asperger's syndrome. And then the doctor said, and you have it too. And I was really sort of startled by this. But we'd spent a lot of time with this guy. So he knew me in somewhat the same way. I did go out and get my own diagnosis. And I bought a lot of literature about it at the time. And it was weird because there was one essay in one of the books which mentioned old records, old films, and true crime as things that Aspie kids, as we call ourselves, might be interested in. And I was thinking, like, oh, my God, did they invent this, you know, disorder just for me? Because this was my fascination when I was a kid.
So how did having a name, a diagnosis for this thing change the nature of your subjective experience?
You know, it did make a change. I just have to tell you something just in passing. John Waters, when he read this book, he said something like...
The movie director.
Yeah, the movie director. And he just said, oh, come on. In my day, we just had weird kids, you know? And,
like John Waters.
Well, I don't think he has this particular
but
thing.
But he was no doubt a weird kid.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess it was helpful for me because it explained... you know, why some things went really sort of badly wrong for me to some extent. I mean, I had quit the Washington Post because I was really tired about writing about music. And I took a job which, in retrospect, was about the worst possible job I could take, which was being an administrator for a symphony orchestra, which involves all sorts of carefully, intricately balanced relationships, which I just couldn't handle. I
mean, with human beings.
With human beings. You know, I'm not patting myself on the back here, but it's really, really tough for me to lie. And that sometimes means for awkwardness and saying things which other people quite rightly deem offensive, but I won't notice it till later.
Were there moments, tell me,
oh,
when you were trying to, you know, be a manager of people where you were unable to do that because of your Aspie-ness?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I remember it from a child. When I was a kid, there was a girl in our class, and she had unusually simian features. She had a big protruding jaw. And, you know, here she is. She's 13 years old. It's the most self-conscious. And I thought it was cool. And I kept telling her, you know, it's so cool. You really look like, you know, you're an ape or something. And what a horrible thing to say. And, you know, I've always felt like writing her a letter, but I just the thought of bringing it back. In St. Louis, the worst thing I did was I was out to dinner with some very, very important donors to the orchestra. And one of them sat down and told me, you know, I have figured out how to make the orchestra solvent. And I said, oh, well, that's great. And she says, all you need to do is put Bolero on every program. And, of course, I laughed. And then I looked at her and I realized she was not joking.
Well, it's interesting that you mention Bolero. In the book, you write that this is exactly the kind of music that you're drawn to.
Certainly when I was a little kid, I was really fascinated by reiteration and doing things again and watching things again and looking at things and visiting the same places and revisiting them. What I loved in Bolero and later on in life in some of the minimalist composers was the sense that I was actually watching life change, that I was somehow caught up in it as it changed. I was interested in the process more than I was interested and where it was necessarily going, if that makes any sense.
It does. That's interesting. So when Steve Reich and Philip Glass came along, you embraced that with a special passion?
Oh, absolutely. For me, the fascination is watching things change, kind of like, kaleidoscopic, for want of a better experience, where it's very much the same, but it's constantly changing.
When you were 13, the filmmaker David Hoffman made a documentary about you as a little pint-sized filmmaker. Let's listen to a little bit of that.
Hello, this is Tim Page. I became a movie producer when one of my good friends, Ken Cameron, started to film an adventure film. Well, we decided not to do an adventure film. His was going to be 150 feet anyway. We decided to film a 25-foot film called A Little Fight with Comedy. I got a pie in my face twice. Michael Flynn, a good friend who you will see in a few movies in a minute, got his pie in the face once.
That's little Timmy Page from 1967?
1967.
As you listen to that today, do you notice Asperger's-iness?
Certainly, if you watch the film, you'll notice some of it. There is a real obsession with detail. I'm talking about how it's 25 feet as opposed to 150 feet.
Yes, I noticed that.
This
like, who cares?
Yeah, exactly. There really was this exactitude. I was fascinated with silent films. Without getting too spiritual about it, it felt like, they were kind of reaching out from another world to me.
Can you trace, actually, the path between what you now know as Asperger's and music criticism, which was one of the things at which you were very good?
I'm very unvisual, but the music somehow evoked a world in which I felt at home, as opposed to the real world, which I did not feel at home in. And still, if I were to shut my eyes right now, I mean, now I'm conscious about it, but and you were to just put something over my eyes and just say, what are you wearing today? There's a very good chance I wouldn't know.
Huh.
I mean, I'm just not visual.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I recently shocked my wife and children by not being able to tell them what color their eyes were.
So, I have no idea what color my dad's eyes were. None at all.
Well, so the fact that that music was this very comfortable place, how lucky for you that you became a music critic. Yeah.
Well, I had film, I had books, I had weird authors, I had, I had things that I could get obsessive about that were at least close enough to normal life that I've managed to be okay with.
And then
them.
You could make a career of it and be
praised
for it.
Exactly. Yeah. I've been very, very lucky that way.
In the 1980s, you hosted a show at WNYC, which is here, where Studio 360 is based. I want you to listen to part of an interview you did back then with Glenn Gould, the pianist.
Oh, sure.
Glenn, are you one of those artists who avoids listening to their own early or earlier recordings, or are you the type who positively relishes basking in the glow of sessions past?
No, I don't think I do much basking, Tim, but it doesn't really dampen my spirits, at least not usually, to be confronted with the sins of my youth. I mean, I've never even believed this sort of interview that one hears again and again on talk shows, you know, with actors who profess never to see or never to have seen their own films. You've heard that sort of thing, haven't you?
Oh, sure. You mean the sort of thing where the interviewer will begin with something like, Sir Don, how do you feel now about your classic Oscar-winning performance in Bridge on the River Hudson?
Bridge on the River Hudson? Oh, yes, I say. That was the film we did in America, wasn't it? Yes, back in the 50s, I think, yes. Well, deucedly awkward location, Thoroughly contaminated stream, thoroughly. Yes, nothing like the Upper Thames, No, not at all. No.
But did you see the picture, Sir John?
Oh, the picture. No, I never saw the picture in its entirety. Of course not.
Well, thank you, Sir John. Don't call us, we'll call you.
Yes, but please do. Of course, they never do.
So anyway, Glenn, unlike Sir John, you do revisit the scenes of your discographic youth from time to time.
Oh, sure, of course I do. Though I
That's the young Tim Page talking to Glenn Gould. Now, that is funny and bizarre. Was that scripted?
Totally scripted.
Yeah.
I mean, and I always thought, even at the time, that was the weakest moment of the whole hour interview. I remember at the time thinking...
Speaking of sins of your youth, happy to bring it back.
Let me explain a little bit about that interview. Glenn, who none of us knew would be dead 6 weeks after that was recorded, had re-recorded the Goldberg Variations, and he sent me a copy of it, and he asked me what I thought, and I listened to it, and I gave him a whole lot of ideas that I of what I thought about it. And he said, well, I need to do a radio interview, but we have to script it all. And so I said, well, okay.
He said we have to script it all.
Yeah. Oh, no, I didn't script any of that. That's all Glenn. And so he took my ideas and then cast me as somebody to play Tim Page, saying things that Tim Page had said to him. And we made this recording in Toronto at about 2 a.m. It was so strange. You know, I have this theory about Glenn Gould. I'm not the only person who has this theory. You remember that scene in it's in the Stephen King novel, I'm sure, but it's definitely in the Stanley Kubrick film.
The Shining,
where I think it's Grady Sutton who plays the elderly black man who takes care of the house. And then there's this little boy who's coming in there with his parents to stay in the inn. And they look at each other and they suddenly say, you've got The Shining. And they understand each other. It's this psychic connection. I think Glenn Gould and I had something of that Shining. Glenn Gould was this legendary genius who no one saw, and I was this kid, you know, scraping by in about 125 or something a week, and, you know, he just took to me, and we were just great friends, and we understood each other, and we could just talk about, you know, degrees of the North, and we could talk about these, you know, our troubles with anxiety, and we really sort of had The Shining. And
retroactively, posthumously, would you presume to say he has Asperger's?
Let me say this. A lot of people have suggested this, including people who knew him very well, including a psychiatrist who wrote a book about him. And when people talk about and they ask my own personal opinion, my own guess would be, yeah, frankly.
Yeah. Are you more at peace with Asperger's today?
It's funny. You know, in some ways, the anxiety is greater now. But what I've learned how to do is avoid situations which are going to be overstimulating and avoid things where I know I probably won't be very good at them. You know, I don't go to many parties where I know nobody and have no specific duty to do. If I have a duty to do, I mean, I could talk to you all day, and, you know, not just because I enjoy talking to you, but interviews are great. You know, TV appearances are fine. Speaking in public is fine.
Because they're formalized.
Because they're formal.
Yeah.
You know, I know what I'm supposed to do. If I don't know what I'm supposed to do, I just want to be anywhere. You know, I mean, you know, if I flee into the night, I'll just feel, you know, at peace again. So I'm not real good at unstructured situations. And I say in the book that, you know, I'm usually most at home either alone or with friends that I've known forever, or occasionally somebody with whom I have The Shining, you know?
Tim Page, thanks very much.
Kurt, thank you. A pleasure.
Tim Page's memoir is called Parallel Play, Growing Up with Undiagnosed Asperger's. We've got more from Tim Page's interview with the late Glenn Gould at Studio360.org. Studio 360 is produced by PRI, Public Radio International, and WNYC. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Pike Medinowski,
Alana Harper,
Aaron Calabria,
Susie Karlowski,
Shalom Pon Oates Ritishai,
Jordan Sale.
And special thanks this week to Alex Ambrose and Andy Lancet.
PRI's Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees, by the Lilly Auchincloss Foundation, by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, at fjc.org, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.